So it's my pleasure to welcome back Siddhartha Shah. Siddhartha has spoken here on the subject of sacred art many times. The reason he's come back tonight and will be returning again in December is to continue this fascinating discussion. He always brings show and tell, and in this case, there's some unique show and tell, as anyone who's had a chance to glance up here earlier will begin to appreciate. But I know he will help us once again appreciate even more these pieces of art, and that's why he's back here. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. I mentioned it a little bit before we were starting, but this talk has brought up some interesting issues for me. I was in Chicago for 2 weeks visiting with my parents and family there, and I did a talk where over half the people in the room were family friends that I had grown up with, whose children were in school with me. So these were parents who compared their children with me, and lots of pressure on their kids, lots of pressure on me, lots of performing for these people as a child. My parents would tell me to play the piano when they were over, and I'd have to play the piano. And so there was just a whole lot of baggage in the room. And it was the toughest crowd I've ever had to do a talk to. And what my response was to be really relying on my outline, doing, you know, this is a talk I've given many, many times before, what I did a few weeks ago in Chicago, and just following it straight through the same information. And what was missing was my kind of authentic movement and passion and what I was talking about. So what made me nervous about this is that the first time I approached this subject on the abstraction of sacred forms was at an academic conference in Orange County a few months ago. And I was on a panel with two professors. I was the only non-PhD or PhD student at the conference. And so people kind of have like a funny response to that. Like, what the hell is he doing on that panel? And the information was quite dry, and it was academic. But when you talk about contemporary art, sometimes you have to get very academic or philosophical about these things. And I'm trying to really avoid that. So my goal is to not rely on my outline so much. The reason I did not go on to get a PhD is because, one of the reasons, is that I want to make this work accessible to people. I don't just want to make the work accessible to experts in the field of something like modern art or Asian art. I don't want to defend my viewpoint to the death. I'd rather just take what information I get out of this work and then make it accessible to people so they can also understand and appreciate it. So when we come to modern art, contemporary art, abstract art, it becomes very, very difficult. It needs to be more of a discussion than me actually telling somebody how to interpret abstract art or how to make sense of it. So I just want to give you some foundational information on the problems that exist, and then everyone will have their own opinions about some of this. Now, I know I've met a number of you. There's also many that I have not met. So I'll give you a little bit of my background. I studied history of art and classics at Johns Hopkins University, and I focused on the representation of gods and goddesses in art, mostly Greek art, but also traditional Indian art and mythology. I work as an apprentice to Robert Beer, who is the foremost living authority on Tibetan Buddhist art. And I myself am a curator, a lecturer, a storyteller, an art dealer. It's very hard to really define what it is I do. But what has happened is in my work with Robert Beer, a lot of what I talk about and a lot of what's important to both of us is the correct transmission of the iconography and symbolism. So I usually work with Nepalese art, which I have some of that here. For those of you who haven't attended my talks in the past, one of the key points is when you're looking at Tibetan Tonka paintings or contemporary religious art coming out of Nepal, a lot of what you see is mass-produced. There are factories set up in Kathmandu where you have, you know, any number of boys kind of lined up filling in color on canvas that's just been photocopied on there. So then what you're getting is not a painting that's authentic. The iconography gets lost. It's not imbued with the same quality. It's not done out of passion by an individual artist. It's a tourist market object. So we're real sticklers for the correct iconography, for really following scripture, depicting a deity as it is supposed to appear. At the same time, in contemporary art, and by that I mean more abstract work, there can be more freedom. So is it really wrong when a modern artist wants to do a painting of a deity and modify it in some way? Maybe not show all the arms, maybe show more arms, maybe change the implements around. So the problem with this, well, one of the problems with this is going into, I'm going to speak just about Hindu art today. In India, we have something called darshan, which I've talked extensively about in the past. Darshan is this transmission of energy that takes place through the process of seeing. So one of the reasons you need an absolutely correct representation of a deity, like there's an image behind Rob up there of Vishnu, which is framed. So Vishnu should appear with four arms, holding a wheel, a conch shell, a lotus flower, and a mace. Now, the way that a Hindu might relate to an image like this, to have this darshan experience, is you look at the deity, and you have this experience of looking at it and being looked at like a mirror. The essence of the deity is also looking at you. There's a blessing force that emanates, is the belief, and there's a transmission of knowledge that takes place. It also kind of ignites devotion in the heart of the viewer. So in order to do this, the iconography has to be correct, because you need Vishnu standing in front of you to have an experience of darshan of Vishnu. So this is why, in traditional, kind of what they call calendar art in India, this is an image of Hanuman. This would very easily be a devotional image in someone's home in India. Why? It's because when looking at an image of a deity in India, the common viewing culture is basically you want darshan. You're not looking at the artistry. You're looking for the experience of darshan. So what you'll have often is a deity facing forward, facing out at you. Large, attractive eyes that are gazing outward. Heavy adornments, typically. So He's got a crown, he's got these heavy gold bangles and rings and necklaces and sandals and flowers. It's a sign of respect. You'll also have, as I mentioned, the hands holding particular attributes. Now, this is because darshan is believed to be communicated through the eyes. So you want to see the eyes of the deity to have an experience of darshan. If you can't see the eyes, you want to look at the hands or the feet. These are the kind of the holiest aspects of the deity. So when any of these things are missing, many Hindus take offense, because the only way they've learned to relate to images of deities is darshan. An image is valued for how strong the potential for darshan is. Now, one of the problems is that, you know, maybe I should have started with this. Religion is, in my opinion, the primary inspiration for most of the art that's been created throughout history. So a dialogue between humans and mankind. But we also have to make a separate area, which is mythology. Religion and mythology are both the primary inspiration for artists. So you had, you know, many cathedrals growing up, many churches growing up in Europe. But you also had, for centuries, European artists doing paintings of Greek mythology, Roman mythology, and using mythology as like an allegory for contemporary struggles. What you have with Hinduism is you have a mythology that is a living religion. Greek mythology, we call it mythology, we don't acknowledge that was actually a religion that existed for a very long time. We think of those deities as being parts of a story that have morals and lessons for us, but there was a time when Venus was worshipped and was a sacred image, when Zeus was worshipped and was a sacred image. So the problem we have with Hinduism is these are religious figures that people are very attached to and very protective of, but they're also, it's an extensive mythology that makes up a part of the larger Indian identity. So by that, I mean that the Mahabharata, for example, or the story of Rama, the Ramayana, these are stories of deities and beings that are a part of the psyche of Indians, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Sikh alike. It's not just Hindus who know the story of Hanuman. Kind of everybody knows the story of Hanuman. So with that in mind, you're going to have artists pulling from these traditional materials to make a new statement about post-partition India or India's independence or the progress of India. This has been very, very problematic. Now, with some of the modern artists in India, that I'm going to show some of their work, when you have traditional images of deities, like the Hanuman I showed, or like something like this, most of the artists who are doing this work, which is called calendar art, they're not necessarily trained in the finest art schools. It's more of a folk tradition. Many of them are self-taught artists who grew up with the stories around them and basic paints and started kind of doing cute, you know, sweet images of the deities. With the modern artists in India, the top artists, they actually went to art schools that were started under British occupation. So M.F. Hussain, whose work I'm going to talk about first, M.F. Hussain was born in 1950. He went to government schools in India under British rule, where he studied British landscape. He studied Picasso, Braque, all the great masters throughout. He had a European education, and he was taught in how artists in Europe were using mythology as an allegory contemporary times. Another thing you learned in art school is to have an image that's facing out at you was considered quite unsophisticated and primitive. You know, Courbet had this thing where you would have realism where the figure, you know, it's considered kind of low art in some schools for the figure to be looking out at you. The figure should be absorbed in some action to make it more realistic. So many of the modern artists were going away from this tradition of doing iconic images and were doing something much more realistic, much more sophisticated in some ways. Now, M.F. Hussain, as I was saying, born in 1915, is considered the grandfather of the modern art movement. He's in his 90s right now. He's received over 7,000 death threats by Hindus for offending religious sentiments. And he's in self-imposed exile, living in Dubai and in London, and I think he was in the U.S. recently. He has had his house vandalized. He's had exhibitions, the work attacked directly, because people have not understood how to look at his work. Now, you have to understand, M.F. Hussain was Muslim. He and his family chose not to move to Pakistan when partition happened, because they identified as Indian. They didn't want to go to some other land. They were from Maharashtra, that region of India. They lived alongside Hindus. They were happy living in India. So as Hindu fundamentalism has been on the rise in India, people have just taken him as a real scapegoat. Anything M.F. Hussain does, the Hindus consider offensive. They're offended by it because he's Muslim. They'll see anything as an attack on Hinduism rather than actually learning to look at his work. So I'm going to show you a few examples of some of his work that was considered very offensive. This is a series of lithographs that he did on the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata is the greatest epic of the Hindu tradition, and it makes an ideal story for someone who wants to make a reference on the contemporary struggles of India since partition. The Mahabharata is a story of two families born of the same blood that are fighting for righteousness. There's a split in the family. It's a tale of dirty deeds, of lying, of deceit. It's also a story of where righteousness overcomes in the end. So it was a perfect way for him to make reference to the split between Hindus and Muslims in India, their history. The Mahabharata is the great war of India, and what he was trying to say is that this story has not ended. We're basically living through this right now. Here is an image that is considered one of his most offensive images ever. This is Ganga and Yamuna, the two river goddesses. Now, as I was saying, with the iconic images that are, you know, very popular and acceptable in India, one of the things you have are outward-facing figures, big, attractive eyes, looking out at you. Heavy adornments. You should see all their hands and their feet. He's completely done away with all of these elements. He's a very intelligent artist. He's a genius, actually. He's an artist who thinks his things through. If you can't understand his work, you know, there's some abstract art where, you know, you can say, well, it's whatever it really means to you. If you can't understand Hussein's work, it simply means you need to look harder and understand a bit more. All of this is intentional. He does not want to evoke some contrived sentimentality in the viewer by doing big, attractive eyes. The hands, people said, Hindus criticize this as having, that he has cut off their hands and feet. He's actually done it to show movement, you know. If he were to add the hands and feet, it might not have the same sense of movement. They're river goddesses. So what he's done is basically, you have some difference in color there, but the contours, the lines of their bodies kind of mimic the lines of the waves. It's like they're one with the river. More than being these adorned goddesses sitting on a vehicle riding through the river, they are the river nymphs, the river goddesses themselves. No eyes. Not attractive. This was a really awful thing for Hussein to do. So they say. Another image. If you ever search him, this one also comes up all the time. This is an image called Draupadi with dice. Is anyone here familiar with the story of the Mahabharata? Okay, I'll tell you a little tidbit of what happens here. You have the five good brothers, they're the Pandavas, and they're married to one woman, Draupadi. They're the good guys, and their cousins, there's 100 or 101 bad guys. So the bad guys get the good guys involved in a gambling match because the oldest brother of the good guys has a gambling problem and everybody knows it. But the game is rigged. It's a game of dice. So first the bad guys say to Yudhishthira, the eldest brother, you know, how about you gamble off your elephants? And he says, sure, and he loses his elephants. He loses his weapons. He loses all of his jewelry, all of his horses, his kingdom. They lose everything. And at the very end, the bad guys say, well, there's one more thing you haven't gambled off, and that's your wife. And so his younger brothers say, you can't gamble her off, you know, that's not fair. But he's completely addicted, and he does, and he loses. So in the moment that he gambles off his wife, the bad guys get a servant and say, you know, bring her in here, pull her by her hair, bring her in, you know, drag her in screaming and kicking. They get her in there, and they want to humiliate her, just basically like a scene of rape. They want to disrobe her in front of everybody. And as the bad guys start pulling on her sari, she starts praying to Krishna to rescue her from humiliation. So as her sari is being pulled, her body is spinning, and Krishna blesses her with a sari that's infinite. So no matter how hard they try to pull the sari off of her, the sari just keeps pulling and pulling, and she's completely covered. At the very end, the guy finally gets exhausted, and she has a freak out. It's a really important speech that she gives, kind of really important for anyone who's interested in literature. She really embodies the goddess in that moment, and it's basically the start of war, is her struggle. Typically, in an acceptable image like these calendar art images I'm showing of Draupadi, she's shown standing kind of as the ideal housewife, like this, and she's got a sari, and then Krishna's hand is going like that and like blessing her, and fabric's coming out of her hand. Nothing on her expression. She's cute, she's smiling, she's very, very attractive, she's wearing bright colors. Nothing actually evokes pain or trauma. Hussein's image is one of horror. She's screaming. She doesn't have eyes, but this time she's got a mouth. She's screaming. She's not naked, although a lot of captions on the internet say that she's naked here. She's literally caught in a game of dice, and it's about her struggle.
It's cute.
Yeah, kind of looks like that. So this was also problematic for Hussein. Really, the whole series was problematic. I'm just kind of pointing out some of the key aspects that were problematic for him. So you can notice again, the problem, I think, is not that Hussein's trying to offend Hindus. It's that he's doing things in a way that the Indian viewing public, or the Hindus in particular, don't know how to see. We've been trained to look at images of deities with a particular projection and expectation. And Hussein's trying to make us question that a little bit more. Hanuman. The story of Hanuman. This is a Hindu myth, but Hussein's statement is basically it's really not fair for a religion to take ownership over a story that has meaning for all of humanity. And the story of Hanuman is basically of a hero who has a very hard time remembering how powerful and strong he is. He is the Superman that we've all been waiting for. He is the force of goodness, and he's a protector. And we're all waiting for that person to come and rescue us from our pain. So this series was done in 1983 or 81, I can't remember, but right after Superman, the sequel, came out. Hanuman is shown tearing his heart open with an image of Rama and Sita inside, which is a common image that you have. I think that calendar art image I was showing had that. But he's depicted him as a modern-day superhero. With the little undies, too.
Do you know him?
The artist? No.
Is he still around?
He is. He just had his birthday. I think he's 94 or 95.
How'd you go visit?
I'm not sure. Not yet.
You never know. I'm 94, right?
Yeah. This is a form of Hanuman setting Lanka on fire. This is an important scene in the story of the Ramayana where to humiliate him, the evil king sets his tail on fire, and then Hanuman takes the tail and starts setting his whole kingdom on fire. So here, this image was described as Hanuman being decapitated. What you actually have is his weapon where his face should be. And the gesture of his hands is actually a gesture that any Indian would immediately recognize as this gesture of like, wah, which people do in music concerts. If you ever go to an Indian music concert, you'll see Indians in the audience and they'll just keep going, wah, wah, wah. And that means like, wow, you know, how incredible, how impressive. So this is Hanuman taking great pride in his own activity.
Is that the same where his feet are cut off again? Is that to show that he's like a kinetic?
In guy? Movement. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Finally, the most offensive image was this one.
Ooh.
Okay. So in the Ramayana, in the story of the Ramayana, Hanuman is sent by Rama. Rama and Sita are married. Sita is kidnapped by a demon, and Hanuman is there to help Ram. So Ram tells Hanuman, go find her and take this ring of mine as proof that I've sent you, and go find out where she is and tell her I'm coming. So Hanuman goes and he finds her, and he says to her, why don't you just jump up on my back and I'll fly away with you, I'll take you back to Rama. And Sita says, no, I want my husband to come and rescue me himself. So Hanuman leaves to go tell Rama that he's found her. But, so this scene doesn't actually happen. He never leaves with Sita on his back. So Hindus took offense at this, saying this never really happened in the story, but they didn't know this. They didn't know the title of the story, of the image, which is Remorseful Hanuman Fleeing Lanka with an Image of Sita on His Mind. So this is Hanuman again. He forgets, he's always doubting himself, he's always wondering whether he's done the right thing. And he's looking back, and he's envisioning Sita almost like a shadow, and thinking, I could have saved her, maybe I could have rescued her in that moment. People who, when I did the conference in LA, someone had to say this, it was expected. People who don't know how to really look at this work, they said, you know, it's like she's holding onto his penis. And that's the immediate response that people have, is that this is Sita holding on Hanuman's penis. And I had to tell the person, you know, that's not what it is. You know, maybe we could see it that way, but that's not really a correct interpretation of this. He's a monkey, that's his tail, you know. It's where his tail would be. He's just kind of artistically shown it that way. This was the image that really got him, that got Hussein many, many death threats. So those are some examples of some of the offensive work that Emma Hussein has done. This is an image by an artist who's about 30 years old in India, and he is meeting with some success, but other artists in his situation have had agreements with galleries to do shows, and then the galleries pull out at the last minute. To me, there's nothing really offensive about this. But again, the deity is not depicted in what would traditionally be considered a beautiful way. He's not wearing all this ornate jewelry. He's not looking out at you. He's not standing in front of you like an iconic form. He's presented in kind of a modern aesthetic, in a playful way. This artist, he reminds me of Chagall. Some of his work reminds me of Chagall. And I'll tell you what's kind of interesting about that is Marc Chagall's work is so playful and colorful and light. There's a sense of playfulness, joyfulness in it. Floating couples, bouquets of flowers, animals, you know, goats playing violins. But Chagall suffered a lot in his life. You know, he was a Jewish artist during World War II, and he had a lot of struggles in his personal life. And yet when he painted, he created this universe that was so playful and so light. It was like he was painting an alternative reality for himself. This artist as well, had a brother who committed suicide, leaving a wife and two kids. This put his parents in shock, and his father died, and then a few months later his mother died. And this all happened in the past year. And he's now the youngest, but charged with his brother's wife and two children, and he recently paid for the marriages of his two sisters. So he's living in this very, very painful reality. And he's also a devout Hindu. But his vision of the deities is one that's not so distant and iconic. It's a world of playfulness. He has a thing for tongues. He often shows deities or figures with their tongues hanging out. This is a great one called the Huntsman.
But are these recognizable deities? I mean, could you say who the first yes. one was?
Or? This is Hayagriva. And this is a horse-headed form of Vishnu, okay. who is the protector of the Vedas. And it's rare to find an image of Hayagriva. Not very common at all, but certainly not one like this.
Right. You know. Those are the same things he's holding, is
yes.
that one up there, right?
Yes, because it is a form of Vishnu. Mm-hmm. This is a calendar art form of five-headed Hanuman. An acceptable, kind of iconic image. And this is that artist's form of Hanuman. So what he's actually doing, you know, like I said, the general Hindu viewing public, they're not people who've studied art history or have studied kind of different ways of looking at art. They know this particular way, which is heavy ornamentation, big eyes, really kind of cute and lovable. But one of the features of watercolor is that the medium itself creates this, it can create this experience of it's there and it's not really there. Watercolor has this effect of being somewhat transparent. And in terms of spiritual art, to me it makes for a really interesting medium because you can have a different experience of darshan. It's not a blessing force that this artist is going after. It's like you have to learn to see them from a different perspective, and you can have a similar experience of devotion or connection with the form. This is a cow-headed forest spirit.
What's that on your teeth?
This is scripture. It's a scripture he's holding. So he's holding a text of it says Srimad Bhagavad Gita. He's got the Bhagavad Gita there. And he's got an axe, a rosary, a flower, which he's putting in his hair. His tongue is hanging out. And then on the Brahmin's thread, which he's wearing, he's got, this is like a traditional puppet from the village of the artist where he's from. So he's including different elements. And incorporating them and to create kind of a new language This is not a deity, but I find it very interesting because he's pulling from an aspect of a deity. It's got three heads, which is, you know, pulling from the history of Hinduism or Buddhism, where you have multiple headed figures.
Well, you say that they don't have, you guys don't have many cats in India.
Yeah, people don't keep cats.
Which, yeah, they're cool. Interesting.
Why does he have a cat?
Why does he have a cat? He likes cats, and he's a Leo.
Oh, you mean the artist?
The artist likes cats and is a Leo.
Oh,
yes.
A cat.
A nice use of
poet.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, a very subtle, as opposed to these things which are put your right in the eye.
Yeah.
You know, he's subtle, he's a color.
Well, you know, I just wanted to show some examples of the work because, like I said, I don't want to go into this very academic, you know, this is what contemporary art is, this is what abstract art should be. It's a different experience. And my whole perspective is basically, darshan is one way of viewing images of deities, and it is completely valid. It's the foundation of all the other talks that I do, which is that there is this authentic transformation that happens through viewing correct images of deities. But there is value in contemporary art as well. What the traditional artists, or the ones doing the calendar art, are trying to do is convey the deities as they look, the correct way that they should look and appear. What the contemporary artists are trying to do is not only make, like Hussein, make statements about contemporary times, contemporary struggles, by using these deities as mythological figures, but it's to express what the deities feel like. And there's a difference here. So Durga, I have never had a connection with the goddess Durga until pretty recently. She appears with a certain number of arms and particular attributes in traditional art. And then I got an image of Durga, which was done almost like one of de Koning's women. This very, very aggressive, expressionist style woman. Very, very powerful. But that communicated something of the energy of the goddess in a way that I could understand. Now, I'd spoken with one spiritual teacher who's got a community in Thailand about traditional art versus modern art. And he said, we must remain clear that a modern expression is inherently a mixture of unconditioned deity energy and those negative karmas of the artist, and therefore can never really represent the deity in totality. That is unless the artist is enlightened, I guess. But I had a really kind of interesting debate with him, which is like, yes, you're right, the traditional, the classical form will present the deity in the correct way, how we might experience it if we're practicing with the deity. But the gods themselves in these traditions are so vast that we can never really see them. We can never really understand the fullness of who they are. But when an artist can kind of channel some aspect of that deity, a personal experience or interpretation of that deity, that's kind of a way in for us as well. It might not be the fullest, most authentic understanding of the deity, but we have access to that figure in a very different way. Does that make sense? And do people have things to say? Because this really is, it's a huge subject, and I'd rather we kind of talk about it. One thing I'll mention is the Piss Christ, which some of you have probably heard about, that this artist had done an image of a crucifixion with Jesus in a tub of urine and then photographed it. And this, you know, had a huge reaction from lots of people. There's, you know, definitely some aspect of it that's offensive, but you know, art breaks tradition, which is one of the things I had in my write-up. Art breaks tradition, it's what it does. And religion is and will continue to be a major source for artists to make commentary on. So something like the Piss Christ, you know, one of the statements that an art critic made was, you know, that kind of lighting, that quality of lighting that you got of this crucifixion with this yellow light, kind of. It was like in a glass case, a tub of urine with the crucifixion and light streaming in, and it was actually a very beautiful image. It had a spiritual quality to it, but he had used urine to achieve that.
So I have a question about that example, and I can locate that one more in being part of the Western culture. When I think about religious are, particularly what you described with iconic images, mm-hmm. that in spiritual traditions, those represent potent forces of visualization that serve a objective function or a spiritual function that's different than an aesthetic function.
Yes.
And that seems like a very different thing than like Piss Christ, mm-hmm. which is more about our relationship to symbols than it is about the inherent force of the, you know, a crucifix is intended to represent.
Yeah.
Now, it's true that religious imagery, when it becomes sort of more of a form, you know, sort of like the American flag, it just becomes a sort of a symbol that everyone feels good about having around. So that's a little bit, I can understand why someone would want to use, you know, Piss Christ as a way to shake that up, but that seems like a completely, completely different thing than the original
yes.
iconic use of establishing a spiritual connection.
That's the thing, is there's been a bunch of crossed wires, you know, in the sense that Hindu art like this, had a function, which was this iconic function that people would kind of practice with and use. But actually the primary function of these kinds of images is for advertising in India. So they're using, they're playing on that thing of Indians, you know, we know one particular way of looking at images of deities. If you have a bag of rice with Hanuman on it, and you have a bag of rice with just a company name on it, people in India will buy the bag of rice that has Hanuman on it. The reason it's called calendar art is because these images, like many rivers, would produce a calendar, a tearaway calendar, with this image on it and then their contact information. And then the person who got that as like a corporate gift or something would keep it in their home. They're not going to throw it away because it's a deity. And because there's a deity on it, suddenly you want to do business with them, you know? So they had this, they were playing, the calendar art movement has played on this religious sentimentality of people, where the artwork really is not about how well done it is, or how sophisticated it is, or how trained the artist is. It's like if you can paint really nice, beautiful eyes, you know, Lakshmi standing on a lotus with a hot pink sari, elephant splashing around her, earrings that are glowing, these big cartoon-like eyes. That's going to be considered like the finest art by the majority of the people in India. But an artist who's really trained and studied and is trying to do something realistic, something a little bit more insightful or aesthetically pleasing, people don't really want to see that because they don't know how to look at things that way. So that's what I think of, is that, you know, the iconic, they were intended as an iconic way, and now they're iconic images, but that's not their purpose. Just like these are not intended to be in a temple. They're not intended to be iconic. Any other comments?
Let me ask a question here. This image that you were referencing earlier,
yeah.
It does not have particularly big eyes. I mean, the eyes
yes.
in relative to the face are not small.
Yes.
But given the composition, the size of the piece and so forth, they're not like these... You know,
right.
balloon eyes sort of grabbing your attention.
Yes.
So this, it seems to me, comes or could be placed somewhere in between these extremes that you're talking about. Maybe you could comment on the position of an image like this in that tradition.
Well, in Nepal, you know, the artists who did that image, most of the artists who are doing the kind of art that I typically deal in and speak about, less than half have trained in formal art school. Most of them do an apprenticeship. Those who studied in art schools didn't do this kind of work in art school. In art school in Kathmandu, you study landscape, you do abstract work, you study the kind of art training that you study in the same tradition that some of the top artists in India have. So he's a trained artist who's very, very skilled. However, his images will not be as popular as images like this in a poster format. And his classmates, who don't do that kind of traditional art, view him as in the same category as calendar artists. Yeah, he's just doing what, you know, everybody's been doing for so long, and do something new. You know, people tell him you should do abstract painting. It wouldn't take you 5 months to do a painting like this, you know. That he is kind of in the middle. He does not get the respect from the top contemporary modern artists. but then his work is not going to, you know, he doesn't necessarily want to just print off posters and sell them.
So how would you describe his intention for the art that he produces? What is his vision of how the image gets used?
He has a connection with God that I feel is a real appreciation and adoration for God. And he's studied the European masters, so he's really trying to blend the two. He's not trying to do something abstract in any way, but he's trying to do something new and contemporary. So what you have is the landscape in the back is almost like a Turner painting, the way that he's kind of done clouds and water. But then the figure is very kind of traditional in some ways. He's trying to use what he learned in art school to create something familiar and iconic.
So what's his view of what his contemporaries who engage in abstract art, what's his view of what they're doing with respect to the traditional iconography?
Like just abstract kind of modern art, what they're doing, or things like this?
Something like that, which is an abstracted representation of these icons.
There, you know, I'm not sure about his particular interpretation of this artist or something, but we have discussed M.F. Hussein, and he finds it very interesting, because they're both working with deities. They're both working with the energies of these beings. So, for example, when someone is doing a painting of Vishnu, he's really absorbed in stories of Vishnu. He might be playing music that are Vishnu chants. He's really trying to get the energy and communicate it in a particular way. And then if you were to see M.F. Hussein's representation of Vishnu, he looks at it with curiosity, you know, and he finds it interesting. But he also has this thing of, you know, well, that could be done in 20 minutes, you know. Anyone could do that in 20 minutes. He recognizes the genius of M.F. Hussein, but he really has respect for the hours and hours of work that some of the more traditional artists put in to their images.
And when he's working, is he engaged in what you might call a prayerful relationship to what he's doing? Or is he working as a technician?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, it's not like these artists, I've said that in other talks, you know, people will see some of the really great masterpieces of this movement and think, you know, wow, the artist must be just chanting the whole time that he's doing this. And really, they're probably just smoking cigarettes and talking on their cell phone with their friends while they're painting. So, like, they have a connection that is obvious when you see the work, but it's, I don't want to dramatize it, you know? Yes.
The people who buy the calendar art are sort of the average, very devout Hindus. Who buys that and who buys those?
Right. That's a great question. The people who are buying, like Gadapa's work, this artist here, it's a mix of those Indians who want to invest in art because they see it as an investment and don't really care what the subject is. And there's people who are, I guess, a little bit like me. And by that I mean we're kind of a younger generation. We have a appreciation and value for our mythology and our stories and our religion, but we relate to something new that's kind of fun and playful. So you have the art collectors who just want to buy it because it's going to go up in value. And that's a lot of art collectors in India right now. Modern Indian art is hot right
these
now.
These two?
This, who's buying Hussein's work?
That's a different thing. Yeah?
Hussein's work is being purchased by people who want status, I think. To own a Hussein, it's like owning a Van Gogh, kind of, you know. It's owning a Picasso, is what it is. And I wish people... It's like with Picasso. I used to sell Picasso's work in a gallery in San Francisco, and I always felt that the people who loved Picasso weren't the people buying it. It's the people who love Picasso typically aren't the ones who can afford Picasso's work. The people who can afford Picasso's work are often the ones who, you know, they can't wait to tell their friends at their next dinner party, you know, about the Picasso they have. So it's kind of, that's kind of what Hussein's work is, unfortunately. But I'm trying to do more and more, you know, articles and work about really studying his work as an important expression of Hinduism and as a really valuable interpretation of these stories.
So even though he gets death threats from the more super religious people. There are the more intelligentsia or the wealthy do actually buy his work.
Yes.
And they do it as a status. That's interesting.
Yes. His work is hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars, his original paintings.
Wow.
His prints, I've seen some for a few hundred, but, you know, one of the Hanuman set, which is here, sold at Christie's 2 years ago for $16,000. It's a set of 10
worth
prints.
A few death threats, I would think.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So he's a status artist. Oh, Gadapa is an artist who, for me, he's, you know, I love his work. I've collected his work for years, personally. It's only recently that I've gotten in touch with him, where I told him I want to show his work in the West. His work is just, it's a playful relationship with God that I see. It's like treating the deities not as these forces that are looking down on us, whose blessings we need, but kind of like this wonderful, magical fantasy world where there's animals and humans in one body, and it's light and it's playful and it's free, which is also an aspect of it. Yeah.
Thank you for showing up here. I'm a practicing Vajrayana Buddhist. Mm-hmm. I almost became a Hindu, like Gandhi a lot. And I've been to India, and I've been told that the Tibetan art, the artists don't sign their names because it's all about not about that. It's not about them getting status or them getting recognition. And what do you know about that?
The tradition was not to sign the work, but plenty of them do now, especially when they're really well respected.
You work with Robert Beer.
Yeah. And
wonderful.
Yeah, he's really wonderful as a person.
Is he? That's great.
I could just go on and on about how great he is.
Wonderful. I love his art.
Yeah, you know, typically the art was not signed because it was kind of an offering, you know, in some ways. But the art is often signed now. What you have in Nepal also is some of the work is not signed. And the shopkeeper will tell you it's because it was some lama who did it, who didn't want to sign it. But often it's the shopkeeper telling the artist, don't sign this. Because they don't want for someone to find out who did it and then go to them directly and commission a painting.
Well, you know, so there's a lot going on in some of those pictures, and I guess you have to be a little accurate. And I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot on some of them.
It's like Samundra's work. If he didn't sign it, you know, there's actually a very, very, very famous, I'm kind of nervous because I know this is being recorded and I'm saying things, maybe I should. There's a very famous artist of Tibetan art who has, like, offered to buy some of the art by some of the top artists in Nepal, and inevitably they would want to put their signature on it, you know. So Samundra needs to sign his work because he deserves the credit.
Of course.
And, you know, some of the really, really best artists deserve the recognition
for their
work, too.
I think they should sign it myself, but I'm being a bad Buddhist by saying that.
Yes.
Towards the end of your talk, you started to mention about the idea of channeling in art. When I was studying art in the 60s in New York, I was going to some of these kind of classy art schools there, and got into being the technician and the illustrator. I had a big easel and a wooden box that opened up with the palette and all the paints and all the things and the studio and everything down in Soho. I was painting, and then the students that I worked with knew. We did some really amazing art, you know, things. It was always the philosophy part, which was discussing what is art, you know. There'd be the one side who'd say everything is art, and then there'd be the others, oh, no, there's a very strict thing, what art is. And one of the things that I got involved with then was in the strict side, it would come up, not only was the idea of kind of a channeling, but not everyone is an artist. Mm-hmm. It's a chosen, it's like the chosen ones. There's a mystique of an artist. And the mystique, when I researched it more and more, I got to know a lot of artists in Greenwich Village and stuff. And it came down to that. They wouldn't say it because there was the channeling word is kind of offensive, but it was like,
yeah,
there was something in the hands that weren't the hands. It was something. And I talked with some artist that an artist that was known for that. He was an older man at the time. I was in my 20s, and he said, "Oh, your work is very stiff, like you were painting, you know, with a pencil. Like you sharpened your pencil every 5 minutes, and you made a, you mm-hmm. know, and it was very contrived." And it was, you know, at first I was unbelievably assaulted because these years of art, you know, that I would hear how great I was. And so I got rid of the. Well, what happened is I was walking down towards 23rd Street on the West Side. And going to the subway, and there was during the day, there was a bunch of kids on the sidewalk, and they had these gigantic colored chalk things, mm-hmm. and they were doing all these drawings, all the whole mm-hmm. sidewalk, you know. And I was looking at this stuff, and I said, "My God, there's things I'm trying to do. This yeah. guy right here, maybe 8 years old, you know, this gesture of things and, yeah. and the color, and the so free, you know. There was none of the rigid in mm-hmm. it, you know." So I did. I got rid of everything. And I got the big stuff, you know. I got chalk. And I went to this, you can get big blocks of chalk and things, and started to just mess around, mm-hmm. art, you know. And I kept hearing this, that unless you have this coming through you, you're not an artist. You're just yeah. a phony, okay? And or a commercial artist or an illustrator. This is what I kept hearing. The insult was to be called an illustrator,
right.
no matter what it was. But the thing was, like, I met a guy that knew Jackson Pollock, mm-hmm. and we talked about that, and he said that in his studio, he said Jackson Pollock would, like, hours to get into a certain place yeah. himself, to get rid of all the negatives that were hounding him mm-hmm. all the time, and he'd get clear. And he said, which is, I still remember, he told me he had cloth wrapped around his shoes, thick, all, you know, roped around with duct tape or whatever, and the same with his hands, and it was like he had things around his ears and his head, trying to get away from the five senses in a way, you know.
Yeah.
And then he said he painted like 2 and 3 and 5 brushes at a time, and his fingers just snap, 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 you know, just trying to get that rhythm in the body as he's trying to do this. And other artists that I knew that mm-hmm. said, I said, "Wow, how did you do that? How do you get a breakthrough?" I said, "I get these walls, I can't." And they said, "Oh, it comes to me.
Yeah.
I don't do anything. I just sit around. And all of a sudden, I'm doing something, you know, on a napkin, and it goes over onto the wall, and it's onto some paper." And so my question is, from what I said, can you speak a little bit on the idea that there's illustration, art, and spiritual art? But I got locked in my head that spiritual art to me is that there's these chosen beings that represent something higher that comes through them, and it comes out in a physical object, either two-dimensional or three-dimensional.
Yeah, wow. That's great. And I know that I probably wouldn't categorize them in the same three that you said. You said there was illustrator, and then something, and spiritual art?
Illustrator would be like you see in a magazine mm-hmm. or an advertisement, some really beautiful watercolor mm-hmm. or ocean scene, you know, or landscape. And then there'll be, say, art, which would be something that we would, you mentioned, I saw a movie recently called Vincent and Theo about, mm-hmm. You know, and his painting and what he was going through. That might be art. I don't know if I'd call it what he did, spiritual. But then there's spiritual, and there's art, even though I'm famous, that you could see, and there's something that comes through to you that says something.
Well, this is why I'm taking more interest in abstract work. Or abstractions of deities, because I think the source is the same. In terms of, you might want to paint an image of Ganesh, and you're an artist who's a little bit more expressive, like you're talking about Pollock, you're still working with that energy of Ganesh, you're still invoking some quality of that, but the way it's expressing itself is very, very different. So to me, that doesn't make that a less valid image of Ganesh. It's just its function is different. It has to be looked at in a different way. You can't judge it by the same criteria. And I think that this idea of artists like Pollock or Basquiat, or even like the surrealists. Miró would do crazy things to paint what he painted, you know. You have to look at this work differently, and it is valid. Like that guru was saying, you know, any image you see, like a modern art, kind of like one of these watercolors you see, it's carrying the negative karmas of that artist. Absolutely. But I can relate to some of those negative karmas, and so I'm not seeing this image of perfection that is this really, really fine, you know, refined, detailed work, but I'm relating to something else. Like in Pollock's work, I look at it and something in me feels like a drunk maniac. And that was like a part of who he was, you know, and we have access to that. We can feel a little bit of who Andy Warhol was in his work, and we can identify those things in ourselves. We can, you know, when he said, it was a quote, I used to saw Warhol's work in this gallery too, and it was like, in his next life, all he wanted to be was a diamond on Elizabeth Taylor's finger or something, you know. Like, you would have these quotes or something, and then you'd see, like, his painting of Elizabeth Taylor, and you just get the guy, kind of, like, the reality he's living in. So his work is very valuable in that way. I don't know. I mean, he was channeling something. He wasn't doing all the work himself, but to make, like, 300 different soup cans or 500 different soup cans or whatever, he's channeling this kind of autistic, you know, obsessive behavior, and we can relate to that, and we can recognize divinity in that. So I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but I think Y. Hussein's work is really valuable. He's an artist who thinks things through, but he's also very expressive in the way that he paints things. Gadapa's work is also very, very expressive. It's an expression of this, like, joy and love and playfulness, childlike quality, you know? And it's just coming out of him in this way. So for me, in some ways, this contemporary abstract work, it's like I get a connection with a deity in some cases where I don't have it in the traditional forms, because it's like I get the artist's experience of it.
Well, but is your spiritual art make you come to spirituality? That's, I mean, I could see doing a sketch of a cross with Christ on it,
mm-hmm.
okay, or a Buddha mm-hmm. drawing, and that's what it is. It's a drawing, but the channeling, I'm not necessarily talking technical here, there's a auric energy that would come out while in the form of the art that the viewer, this is the important part to it, not the artist and the thing. Then after the artist is gone, the viewer looks at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I did the one, Bascardi, is that it?
Basquiat.
Basquiat. He has that, I saw the one of him with the boxer,
mm-hmm.
The fighter. And it's just the box, but as, I don't know, it's the male macho thing. Mm-hmm. But I really, wow, it overwhelmed me to see that.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm not saying spiritual, but there are people, you see art that affects you,
mm-hmm.
okay, it does cause something to happen. So what I'm trying to get to, I think, is because the topic was something like a spiritual art, and I'm not holding you to it because I know
right.
we're getting recorded here, so I don't know, you know, later on you might have to count for this, but...
I don't mind, yeah. I've said all sorts of ridiculous things.
But the idea of the spiritual being that if a person who has no art abilities at all just walking down the street going, oh, look at that, and it just all of a sudden goes, oh, there's more to life than this bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm really, oh, I'm overwhelmed, and I'm going to now become a whatever. You know,
I could speak to that.
Yeah.
In Sacramento, there's a Vedantic society with mm-hmm. big gardens, landscape sculpture gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, it's very beautiful. You should go there. It's right off of Fair Oaks Avenue. You can Google it and find out Vedanta in Sacramento. But I was wandering through there, and there's a little lake, and there's little islands in the middle of the lake, and I crossed the bridge. And in the gazebo in the middle, there's a statue. And it's Krishna playing the flute, about just a little taller than I am, mm-hmm. but about the same size. And so I came around, walked all the way around it, and wound up looking into Krishna's eyes while he was playing the flute, and completely got Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Completely, deeply fell in love. at that moment with Krishna. So that was a revelation of the possibility of transcendental experience mm-hmm. that can be offered
yeah.
by art.
Yeah, and it could be in terms of the spiritual art, you know, that is an outer spiritual form. A painting of Krishna is obviously intended for, or a sculpture of Krishna is, you know, it's got, the subject is already religious, it's done in a beautiful way, so it evokes that, it has the power to evoke that, or the possibility. But to me, you know, according to Vedanta, one of the things is what the creation does is it creates. That's just the kind of nature of things, moving and creation. So any kind of creation of some sort, it is an expression of a divine energy. There's this book called The Knitting Sutra that I read once because I like to knit. And knitting can be a deeply spiritual practice for people. It's been for me, it's repetition. I can do my mantra while I do it. I met a woman when I was in Chicago who does art. What she does is she takes these busts, like mannequins, and she collects brooches and really flashy buttons and things, and then she spends hours sticking them on so that the whole thing is covered in all this bling, all this, you know, stuff. We're looking at art, and she asked me, so what is tantric art? Because I feel like what I do is tantric art. And on the outside, you would think, no, not at all. You kind of, you know, decorate things with, like, sequins and buttons. But you could tell that this was her spiritual practice. She was working through something. When is it spiritual? You know, people have different views of this, that it should be transformative for the artist and for the viewer. You know, Gurdjieff had his own views on objective art and what that meant, you know, that I can't really speak about very much. Whether it needs to be just purifying or transformative for the artist, is that enough to consider it a spiritual piece? Do I have to respond in a spiritual way? What makes it spiritual? You know, to me, one of the most incredible paintings I've ever seen is called The Beheading of Lady Jane. And it's in London, and it's of Lady Jane, who I think was 17, being in like a white satin dress, blindfolded, being carried over to where her head was going to be cut off. And I saw that painting, and that's one of the most profound spiritual experiences I ever had. The way that the painting was staged was like it was really happening, you know? And that brought home like death to me in a way that no painting of the god of death has ever done. No death in my family that I've heard has done the same thing that painting did.
What about in the Bible? It talks about how God wrote the flame in the rock with Moses, you know, and did this, you know, it's an art form, rock, mm-hmm. right? In the flame, the whatever, you know. That would be, would that be like the purest sense of spiritual art? When God himself would have to etch things in.
Well, you know, my response to that is like a really ridiculous answer, but it's kind of like we are all God's etchings, kind of. So it's like this whole creation is God's finest art.
Right.
So anything is really God's finest art, and that's why to call something spiritual art and not spiritual art is like, that's why, you know, abstract art has great potential to be spiritual. One of the things I didn't get to is yantras or mandalas are very, very abstract. They're just shapes, triangles, doing all sorts of things, and that's abstraction. But the problem in Hinduism is abstraction of figures, of figurative beings. Is where
God didn't sign, when he did that, he didn't sign it, so it turned out.
Yeah. Well, that's what I have to say for now. This is more something to contemplate than anything else. And I really wish I could speak to more Indians about this. Of course, last time I did, like I said, I did it at this academic conference. I really got in trouble. Yes?
So it seems like there's a kind of spiritual religious rigidity in India. I mean, it's just like...
Everywhere, I would say.
Yeah. They did the cartoons of Muhammad,
yes.
And then people, there were death threats and things like that. So, but with the nouveau riche, yeah. Is that still the case?
What's still the case?
That rigidity, that fundamentalism.
Yeah. Someone once said to me, you know, Hinduism is a very open religion, but Indians are not a very open people. And that's one way of kind of looking at it. No, fundamentalism is it. I mean, it's the it thing right now in so many places all around the world. And yes. And one of the how do I say it? You know, one of the responses I've had, like at this conference where someone was talking about how offensive the work was, is I just said, look, I'm a Hindu, and I don't think that God needs me to defend. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't think God needs for you to defend him, like, in this image of God. And that was just my kind of, you know, I know other people might have different views of that, but I think, like, this is, like, it in our religion. I'm sorry you don't like this image of Hanuman, but I'm not about to go fight his battle, because I don't really think that Hanuman is offended, you know? If he's offended, then he's really sensitive. Plain and simple, you know? But this is the fundamentalist view. Like, there's protest images of people saying that, you know, modern artists should have their hands cut off for offending these gods. It's like, the gods aren't offended. And if they are, they're going to get karmic retribution somehow. So butt out, you know? But what I've seen with the nouveau riche is actually, there's one artist in South India who's doing these incredible iconic images of the nouveau riche of India. And they're amazing. There's lots of like Indian women with sunglasses wearing their saris and shopping bags, and he's got one painting of a woman just covered in gold bangles wearing these really fancy sunglasses, and she's like leaning over a counter and just looking up at the eyes of a salesperson. And it's called Dubai Duty Free. And it's done in this, like, their eyes are big and they're covered in gold, but it's the nouveau riche, you know?
It's a different kind of idolatry.
It is. Yeah. But this is where there's a lot of crossover, and this is, you know, yeah, it's part of my thing to say I specialize in sacred art, and it's what I believe in, and at the same time, I've always said, I'm not here to defend that sacred art is the only kind of art, you know, deities are the only kind of art people should have. We can have that experience with anything, you know.
Where do you live?
I live in Lake County.
So you don't live in India?
No.
But you're born.
I love India, and I really don't want to live there. I was born in the States, and I go to India every year, and I spend a lot of time there. But at this point, the state that we're from, where a lot of this modern art is happening, is the most conservative state in India, too. So it's not really a place I want to be.
Mm. What state is that?
Gujarat. So,
thank you, everybody.
So much.
Most of you know the drill. We have a donation bowl over on the counter, and we hope you will contribute to it, which will help support the work of our speaker and help maintain this space.